Hello and welcome to this podcast. Glaucoma is a leading cause of irreversible blindness and affects approximately 80 million people globally, with projections to exceed 111 million by 2040. We know that the elevated intraocular pressure is the key modifiable risk factor, which is why reducing intraocular pressure is central to treatment strategies. In this podcast, expert faculty from the featured symposium at the 2025 Envision Summit share insights about interventional glaucoma co-management. Those faculty include ophthalmologists Rachel Simpson from Moran Eye Center in Salt Lake City, Utah, James Murphy from Connecticut Eye Physicians in New Haven, Connecticut, Mary Q from the Cleveland Clinic's Cole Eye Institute in Cleveland, Ohio, and optometrist Jessica Steen from the Nova Southeastern University College of Optometry in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Listen as Dr. Steen sets the stage with an overview of glaucoma risk and progression and target pressure.
Now, we understand, of course, that glaucoma is common and becoming increasingly more common. Now, we can think about the risk and our understanding of glaucoma under diagnosis in a general population, and of course, also keeping in mind the difficulty, truly, in diagnosing disease that relates to often the overdiagnosis of glaucoma in a clinical environment. Now, we understand that individuals who are Black or African American are much more, six times more likely to have glaucoma than white individuals, and are more likely to have vision-affecting glaucoma. And also important to keep in mind, Hispanic and Latino individuals are expected to make up of half of all glaucoma patients by 2050. So certainly when we think about management strategies, we think about long-term care of individuals with a diagnosis, and this is where the collaboration between optometry and ophthalmology truly does play a role. We think about these patients not just as far as short-term treatment, but management throughout their life. And that's where, when we think about management strategies, medications, interventional procedures, both certainly play a role through the course of that patient's disease and disease progression. When we think about after the diagnosis has been made, the American Academy of Ophthalmology preferred practice pattern in managing patients with primary open-angle glaucoma, and we think about how this reflects to our personal practice patterns and certainly what our goals are maintaining this visual-related quality of life through that patient's lifetime, which we can relate back to structural stability and, of course, ideally functional stability, but still with the understanding that as disease progresses, as we're treating patients for 30, 40, 50 years through their lifetime, of course, progression is expected, and this is where we're trying to slow the progression to maintain that patient's functional, visual quality of life. We think about setting a target pressure. Now, this is not something that is intended to be exact, and this is something to be expected to change through that patient's course of management, again, as their disease changes and as they increase in years. Now, keep in mind that as we're setting a target pressure, it really is our best guess based on that patient's risk factors for not only disease development, but progression, and of course, their past progression to the point where they've arrived in our office. Generally, when we're talking about primary open-angle glaucoma, we're talking about at least a 25% reduction in peak untreated intraocular pressure. And of course, this is going to be individualized to that patient based on their past progression and risk factors for future progression. Now, we do also, of course, have to keep in mind the risk and benefit, real spread and balance in any individual. Certainly, over-treatment can be just as challenging in certain cases as under-treatment, as we understand the real challenge that patients have with adherence in medical care. That can be office visit follow-up as well as medical treatment. Now, the American Optometric Association late in 2024 released their evidence-based clinical practice guidelines. So we do have two professional associations that really do agree as far as how we manage our patients with glaucoma.
Here, Dr. Steen shares data on practice patterns and reviews medical therapy for glaucoma.
Now, when we look at treatment patterns in open-angle glaucoma, this was, again, a claims database that was published in 2021, but utilized data that was gathered between 2007 and 2014. So something important to keep in mind is we're evaluating and we're comparing this data to the patients in our practice. This is a snapshot subset that reflects, again, as early as 2007. Now, what was determined is that initially, 71% of patients newly diagnosed with open-angle glaucoma were initially treated with a medical monotherapy, and the majority of those patients were prostaglandin analogs. Now, I know when I look at this, I'm genuinely surprised that only 56% of newly medicated, newly diagnosed open-angle glaucoma patients were treated with a prostaglandin analog. The second most common class as a single monotherapy in a newly diagnosed glaucoma patient was a topical beta blocker. Again, as we're comparing our current practice patterns to those between 2007 and 14, we do have to be mindful of the advances and the changes in current practice. What was really highlighted is that in this initial 4 years after diagnosis, 64% of patients required a treatment modification, really a treatment escalation. And of those patients who required at least one treatment modification, the majority of patients required an additional modification. I think this is important and truly reflective of our own practice, where we say, yes, certain individuals may be stable for a four-year period, and this particular is reflected in this particular trial, on a single treatment over that period. But for patients who have one escalation in therapy, there's often a further escalation that is required. Now, if we think about topical therapies, you know, we really are at a point where it's not just only about lowering the intraocular pressure. We're thinking about how we're lowering the intraocular pressure. And I think this really reflects well when we talk about surgical procedures and interventional management and strategies, that really that thinking has shifted to medical therapy as well. Of course, prostaglandin analogs targeting primarily uveoscleral outflow, and newer therapies. Latanoprostene bunod, the impact of a nitric oxide donating prostaglandin analog on the trabecular meshwork and distal pathway system. And notarcetol is a Rho kinase inhibitor, once again targeting primarily the trabecular meshwork to increase trabecular outflow. More traditional therapeutics, we think about the aqueous suppressants. Now, we understand that open-angle glaucoma is not an aqueous inflow disease, however, aqueous suppressants do still play an important role in medical therapy, whether that is an alpha-adrenergic receptor agonist, a topical beta blocker, or carbonic anhydrase inhibitor. Again, topical beta blockers typically not currently prescribed as a single agent, especially as a first-line therapy, but especially as we think about escalating medical therapy, very difficult to avoid, especially in fixed-dose combinations. Now, again, when we traditionally look at medical therapy, we understand the safety and efficacy profile of the major categories of medications, prostaglandin analogs and Rho kinase inhibitors in addition. When we're looking at the safety profile of topical beta blockers, we do have to be aware of the systemic underlying disease processes that may be a contraindication, primarily those individuals who have pulmonary disease, but also watching for patients who may have a baseline low pulse rate or maybe asymptomatic bradycardia. And again, we think about our alpha-adrenergic agonists, topical carbonic anhydrase inhibitors, and pilocarpine.
In this next segment, Dr. Murphy gives an overview of MIGS with some added commentary from the other faculty.
So just to categorize it here, we have trabecular bypass, that's stents. We have excision. And then when we're talking about goniotomy, we'll go into a little bit of detail, but there's a difference between excisional and incisional goniotomy. There's canaloplasty devices, which oftentimes will also do an incisional goniotomy. And then there's suprachoroidal devices as well. So it's interesting, looking at the MIGS timeline, there's been quite a bit of a proliferation in this surgical space just in the last decade, essentially. Kind of the old school original was the trabectum way back in 2004. You know, and so that was indicated for ablation of tissue within the eye using electrocautery. So, you know, there's kind of a nuance when it comes to FDA approval for a surgical manipulation versus an actual diagnostic indication. And we'll go into that. But, you know, the eye stent, which came out in 2012, that was the first MIGS device that that was really had a randomized controlled trial that was for primary open angle glaucoma, mild or moderate. You know, and with some of the reimbursement challenges that have been coming up more recently, that nuance to how MIGS devices are FDA approved is probably going to become more and more of an issue as time goes on. So a lot of stuff here. We're going to start with trabecular bypass. And so the evolution of that, you know, iStent was the original in 2012. They had a improvement with the inject. Then we got the Hydrus microstent, which is a device, you know, I mean, I use really all of them. You know, and then the Infinite came in 2023. And so, you know, you see this sort of evolution of in you know, every space, especially in the MIGS space. So the Hydrus microstent, we'll just touch on that. This is a flexible biocompatible nitinol device, and it's curved to match the average Schlemm's canal curvature. It's 8 millimeters in length. There's 3 open windows facing the anterior chamber that kind of stretch the TM over that, so you know aqueous can flow through. And then an unobstructed surface facing the collector channels. And so this device just kind of you know, it just slides in through the actuator. And I just provided here a couple of examples of it sort of actual, you know, stenting open Schlemm's canal and stretching the trabecular meshwork there. Because we know, you know, the primary resistance to outflow is the trabecular meshwork. The reason why I included the Horizon trial is because it's probably the example of the best evidence we have that MIGS reduces the rate of progression and works, lowers IOP, reduces rate of progression. And this is a very, you know, this is a big randomized controlled trial. The cataract control arm is that's great data too. And, you know, I guess props to them just for continuing this analysis. We have the 5-year data, and then eventually we're going to have the 10-year data too. So that's, you know, glaucoma is a disease that is lifelong. And so when it comes to these devices, studying it for longer periods of time, I think is more relevant. So next, I just called this trabecular disruption because there's various surgical ways that we're able to accomplish this. So trabectome, that was the original, and that's ablative goniotomy, essentially. It uses electrocautery to burn away trabecular meshwork. I remember doing this in fellowship way back in 2015, but it had been around for a decade before that. So. The trabectome and the original iStent were my first exposures to MIGS devices, actually. Then the Kahook dual blade that came along, that performs an excisional goniotomy, so you're actually using those two paired blades to remove trabecular tissue. This is Scion. It's a device, it actually, so it doesn't use blades. Trabecular meshwork is, you know, it's like tissue paper. It's very, very thin. Very slight, and so this just kind of strips it away and collects it in a loop, essentially. But it is also removing that trabecular meshwork tissue. And then finally, Trabex Pro. This one's a little newer. This is by MST, and it actually, you know, for trainees, I don't know if you guys use this with trainees, but what's nice about this one is you actually hook it up to the irrigation and aspiration of your phaco emulsification machine. And so you can really, you know, you can clear heme like live in real time as you're doing it. You know, it keeps the anterior chamber inflated nicely. And so this is also a great device too. And I really like the, tip. Okay. And so finally, we're getting to canaloplasty here. And so GATT's pregoniascopy assisted transluminal trabeculotomy. So the Glaucoma Associates of Texas, that group sort of developed this this technique here in the U.S. So it's an ab interno trabeculotomy. You canalize Schlemm's canal with either a suture originally, like proline, or eventually when it was available, a microcatheter, which then you manipulate with intraocular forceps. So this involves an incisional goniotomy or TM stripping. You can do it truly 360 degrees because it's, you know, you're putting it all the way around. It's like a lasso, essentially. You can remove it in lasso form if you want to, 360 degrees. It does require clear cornea, good gonioscopic view, you know, and then you have to become familiar with manipulating suture or the microcatheter with a microforcept. But we have some improvements in this technology. Streamline is a device. There's some discussion how to code this, if it's canaloplasty, if it's something slightly different than that, because it does goniopuncture, and then it injects on both sides. 8 injections up to of 7 microliters of viscoelastic, so 56. I've used it. You know, I like the devices a little bit more that, at least in my practice, that actually introduce a microcatheter or something with a lumen that can actually extrude viscoelastic into Schlemm's canal, just because I like to be able to have, you know, the Streamline is a little bit limited to your nasal 4 or 5 clock hours, where I really want that 360 action. So. Then we come to the Omni surgical system. So this uses a nylon flexible device with a lumen. You can go 360 degrees through Schlemm's canal. You just have to flip it and then recannulate, so it does 180 and 180. And it extrudes 5.5 microliters of OVD twice for a total of 11 microliters volume. And, you know, one of the nice things about this is it's multiple indications, any severity. So in terms of billing and coding, there's a lot of flexibility there. And I think that it works in a lot of different types of glaucoma and different severities. There's just a little zoom in there. Let's see. And then finally, we get to the iTrack Advance here. And so the microcatheter contained within this device used to be the 250A model, and that was the one that you had to manipulate with a intraocular forceps to cannulate Schlemm's canal. Now it comes in this nicely packaged device with an actuator, and so that blue button there with the ridges on top just slides. As you slide that with your finger, it deploys the microcatheter 360 degrees in one pass. So there's no need to do any flipping, or you just, you know, once you get in there, that's kind of like the rate limiting step, is just getting the device securely into Schlemm's canal. That's kind of maybe the hardest step of doing this kind of a procedure. I don't know, when you're working with trainees, is that kind of like that's the thing? It's like, get it in Schlemm's canal, yes. And then once you're there, you're like, okay, we got it. Now we're good.
Next, Dr. Simpson talks about MIBS, or minimally invasive bleb surgery, and suprachoroidal options.
For a hot second, they called Zen. They tried to loop it into the whole MIGS revolution. And I think as glaucoma doctors, we all immediately said, whoa, this is a little bit different. And then I think did what he did, which is brand things. So this was instead branded instead of MIGS. Zen and some of these other filtering devices were branded MIBS, minimally invasive bleb surgery. And of these, really, the Zen gel stent is currently the only one that we have available to us in the United States. It's a subconjunctival bleb-forming stent that's biocompatible. It's made of gelatin. It's actually really interesting and occasionally incredibly frustrating, because prior to exposure to liquid, it's very solid. And then after you implant it, it becomes malleable and almost essentially the consistency of gelatin. So if you are trying to manipulate it after it's already essentially been exposed to any eye fluid, it becomes very difficult to manipulate. And then the interesting thing about this, you know, this is essentially, when you look at it, this is a tube without a plate. And so what's restricting our flow in the Zen stent, rather than relying on, say, a valve and an Ahmed valve, is physics. And my glaucoma fellowship mentor, Alan Crandall, would just occasionally yell the word physics at me whenever I was doing anything wrong, to remind me that you can't overcome the laws of physics. So this is an example where actually the laws of physics are our friend. So it really is the length of the device and then the internal lumen of the device that is what protects you from hypotony in this case. And it is implanted, it was designed initially to be implanted ab interno, so that you're not having to dissect conge. There's a needle device that delivers the stent into the trabecular meshwork, and you tunnel that needle up through underneath the sclera. through the tenon so that you can see it just under conjunctiva, and you inject it. And I think the evolution of Zen surgical style is something that really tells us a lot about the innovation of glaucoma surgeons. So when, I'm going to just go ahead and play this and talk through it. When Zen first came to market, we all tried to do it. This is another thing that came out during fellowship. We all tried to do it the way that it was recommended through the company. And one thing that we all immediately realized was that our re-needling rate for this thing was astronomically high. And that's because the preferred surgical method that was recommended didn't really make sure that the Zen was sitting purely on top of tenons. And so it would inevitably get embedded within tenons. Tenons would do what it would do, which was like just strangulate the external lumen, and you'd get immediate fibrosis. And so we'd be needling these things after 2, 3, 4 months, and then having to move on to something else. And so that's where the whole glaucoma community stepped in and said, hey, maybe we need to rethink, maybe it's not the device that's the problem, maybe it's our surgical approach that's the problem. So this is an example of Ike, again, doing what he did and innovating new ways of doing the same thing. And he's like, well, the problem is that we're injecting it into tenons. Let's make sure we're not injecting it into tenons. So he had the idea of injecting air and then viscoelastic and doing a pneumodissection of the conjunctiva so that you are sure that you don't have tenons mixed up. And when you do your injection, the needle's going to be right underneath conjunctiva, and tenons is going to be below the device, so you're not going to have that strangulation from tenons. PreserFlow has been the magical unicorn that has been talked about since I was in residency. Just wait until we get PreserFlow, which I think when I was a resident was actually called InFocus. And it's coming. The promise of being saved by the all-powerful PreserFlow was just dangled in front of us. It's been 10 years, and it's still not available in the United States. It has been available in Canada and the UK and Europe, I think, this entire time. It is still currently trying to get FDA approval here. One day, we may be so lucky, but essentially, PreserFlow is another MIBS device. It is a bleb-forming shunt that goes above the conjunctiva, and essentially kind of a similar design to what we saw with the Zen with a few little nuances that I don't think it's necessarily worth talking about. But again, this is the savior that is promised and has yet to materialize, but one day hopefully we'll be there. The doors were open for suprachoroidal MIGS options to us with CyPass back in 2017. And those of us who got a chance to use it saw that it could be really effective. I mean, these were patients who'd be on 4 drops. It was your last ditch effort before you could do a TRAB, and you'd put in a CyPass, and their next day their pressure would be 8 off all medications. And for a while, we thought, again, this was going to be the savior. This was the cure for glaucoma. And of course, it didn't end up being that because that magical unicorn doesn't exist yet. But it did work really well. You would have some patients who maybe 6 to 8 months later, there would be a little cleft around their CyPass that would eventually close and their pressure would go up and they'd have to go back on drops. But the real problem with this was that they did a study that showed 30% endothelial cell loss at 5 years if more than 2 of their retention rings were in the AC. And so at that point, rather than facing a mandatory FDA recall, the company pulled it off the market. At that point in time, you guys may have heard of iStent Supra. Glaukos was in the process of developing Supra to compete with CyPass. They saw what happened with CyPass. They essentially stopped investigating that one, and it's essentially been on pause ever since. So nothing's happening with Supra. It is not currently available, and we don't know about endothelial cell loss, or if we do know, it hasn't been. It's not easily available. I was also asked to talk about the Solex Gold Shunt, which is like the old school OG suprachoroidal option. This was something that was developed back in the early 2000s, never available in the United States. But again, similar to the CyPass, it kind of created a cleft, a cyclodialysis cleft, and sat in that cleft to keep things open. It ended up causing a lot of inflammation in the AC, so it was never able to get FDA approval, although I think it is actually still available in Europe. Currently, The two best options for this are going to be the AlloFlow, which was recently FDA approved. It is made of biocompatible scleral allograft. And you go in when you're doing this surgery, you actually create, they give you a cyclodialysis spatula as a part of the kit for surgery. So you go in and you create a cyclodialysis cleft. Then you put the injector in the cyclodialysis cleft and inject these scleral allograft patches that are essentially space holders that keep the cleft permanently open. Even as the cleft closes, that scleral material is permeable, so it allows fluid to flow back and forth. And then the mini-ject is the other kind of thing in this category that is pending. They just got approved for their pivotal trial in 2022, so that is ongoing. And it's a biocompatible silicone stent, so they're hoping it won't have the same endothelial cell loss issues that we saw with CyPass. This is what the AlloFlow looks like, so you can see the cleft around it, and that little white square is the scleral allograft. And it sits, you can see in this UBM, really sits in between the iris and the sclera and keeps that cleft open. And then again, this is just what the mini-ject looks like. It's the same idea. It looks very similar to what the old CyPass used to look like, but instead of being rigid, it's made of silicone. So these are all pretty new options.
Listen as Dr. Q and the faculty panel discuss best practices for co-management of glaucoma by ophthalmologists and optometrists.
I'm an ophthalmologist, and I worked at University of Chicago for the last 5 years, where I was the sole glaucoma MD in my department for that whole 5 year period of time, with the exception of 8 months when I had somebody else join, but then he left. And so it is pretty hard to be the sole glaucoma surgeon for like an entire academic department. And so I leaned really heavily on my optometry partner, Patik Amin, who will also be here on Sunday. And the two of us will be both speaking at the optometry panel together on Sunday morning. So for 5 years, he and I were essentially the entire glaucoma service. And we just kind of had a really great time building that practice together because we were hired at around the same time. And so it wasn't like one of us is joining the other and had to adapt to the other person. We actually got to build it from scratch together, which was really cool. And so we had our academic day on the same day. So we would meet frequently to talk about making our notes formatted a certain way so that we could, you know, understand what the other person was saying, because we could just treat the other person like an extension of ourselves because we were speaking the same language in terms of the note formatting. Talking to each other about, you know, when does he refer for what, and then when do I do procedures for what, so that we could minimize the chances of you know, him referring me to somebody to me for something, but then me not agreeing with him or vice versa. And so that was like a really productive working relationship. Basically, I was only seeing patients who needed procedures, and he would see the patient until they needed a procedure and then refer to me to talk about doing the procedure and then do the procedure. And if they were refusing the procedure, then they would just go back to him. If they had the procedure, they would then just go back to him. And that would really free me up to be accessible for more patients who needed procedures, because I was a little bit of a bottleneck there performing the procedures. We both left University of Chicago, so I'm now at Cleveland Clinic, where I am one of six ophthalmology MDs, and we don't have a dedicated optometrist who works with the glaucoma service, but as part of my negotiation for this new job, I said we must hire an optometrist and more optometrists to join specifically the glaucoma service so that the ophthalmologists can be available to see new patients who need surgery and do maybe more days a week in the OR for surgery, and so that our optometry partners can help see the patients with non-procedural needs so that we can essentially increase access to patients widely. So we're actually interviewing this candidate right now. I was trying to get her to come to Envision, but it was like a little bit too last minute, but I'm really hoping that she'll join us next year. And meanwhile, Patik is at UIC now, so in Chicago still, where he's working with a new team of two different ophthalmologists, and they did not have a glaucoma optometrist before either, so he's trying to, you know, build up a partnership with them where they can figure out how to work together. So for example, he has told them, you know, you don't have to send me everybody who's stable if that's not what you're used to, but maybe every single clinic identify like three people who are stable enough to come to me instead of following with you, because he has noticed sometimes he has trouble getting people in with them when it's time for surgery. Maybe they're booked out for 3 months. And so it's important to just kind of have like a synergistic relationship between the two sides to keep access for the patients. I literally only have this one slide And so this is just a summary of the roles and responsibilities of the OD and the MD when it comes to caring for glaucoma patients together. I was hoping maybe you could comment a little bit on what your practice is like and how do you interact with optometrists in your area, or I don't know if you have optometrists in your practice, and how do you sort of divide up these roles and responsibilities as it comes to accepting referrals and sending people back, et cetera?
Yeah, so co-management is absolutely 1,000% essential to how I practice, because I work just part-time for four different practices. And so each one of those practices kind of has a built-in team, and some of those practices also have a pretty extensive OD and MD referral network. And so just knowing all those people, meeting them, you know, sitting down and discussing, you know, cases and like how, like what's a good referral, what can, you know, maybe stay at the referring practice or stay with the optometrist or the non-surgical MD or whoever that may be, because my, you know, role essentially is to go in and do almost 100% surgical consultation and surgeries, and then the majority of the post-operative management, you know, I do maybe 10% of that, and the other 90% is done by ophthalmologists and optometrists that are, you know, well-versed in the post-operative management of glaucoma patients. So that's, without co-management, there's no way I would be able to do the amount of surgical care that I do.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience. Yeah, it seems like we can all agree that excellent communication in both directions is really critical for having effective co-management, because otherwise if you're just receiving a consult and you don't have any records, you don't have any prior testing or any idea what the patient's been sent for, and the patient doesn't know either, they're going to be a little confused. So I think optimizing communication is really key here.
That's it for today. Thank you for listening to this podcast.